And our case is 05-1120, the United States v. Odell Corley. Good morning, Mr. Friedman.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I would like to discuss two issues with the Court. The first one is whether the appellant was denied a fair death penalty hearing before the jury due to the omission of the unadjudicated homicide that occurred in Atlanta. And then the latter issue I'd like to briefly discuss is whether there was a Batson violation by exercising the parental challenge to exclude a black prospective juror. At the minimum, the omission of the unadjudicated homicide in Atlanta caused the death sentence to be imposed under the influence of passion and prejudice. This is especially true when the horrible photographs of the burnt deceased.
Now,
wander.
A number of circuits have held that the use of unadjudicated criminal proceedings, conduct, during sentencing does not violate the Constitution. Can you cite to any appellate cases that have held that such use violates the Constitution?
I believe not, other than in one published decision, the Gonzalez case. However, that issue has not been reached and decided by the Supreme Court of the United States. This is a direct review, so we don't have Teague and we don't have all those underlays of state habeas. And ultimately, I believe that issue is going to be resolved. But even more, and we preserve that issue in the brief, but we also argue that the statute itself prohibits criminal convictions. Once again, that's an issue that has to be resolved. But more importantly, putting aside all these, you know, legal procedural questions, we think even on the facts, the unadjudicated murder should not have been submitted in this case.
But then how do you respond to the argument that the photos were probative to demonstrate the violent manner of death and the depravity of the crime, which would be relevant to his character and the threat of future violence?
Well, first, we think it shouldn't have been admitted at all. But taking the argument, assuming just for the moment that the unadjudicated homicide should be admitted in the case, the photographs weren't necessary. There was testimony concerning the incident in quite detail about her condition, both by, I believe, Lieutenant Phillips in the record, and also by the original officer that was on the scene describing in detail her condition. And so there was no need to show these horrific photographs. Normally, when you see these issues, and I've seen them, you know, raised, usually, of course, in habeas, not on direct appeal, they come in with the horrible photographs, and that's a throwaway issue. But the case law is there for this type of photograph, and these photographs are just totally inappropriate. You can look at these photographs, you can't even identify it as a human being. It would be just as inappropriate to dig up a body and show somebody, here, this is what a body looks like being in the ground for a couple
of
months.
But a lot of those photograph cases are where the prosecution has introduced multiple photos. And the shots here, there was one headshot and then one shot on the back.
We're not talking about the multiple issue here. We're talking about the horrible.
I'm just saying, though, that when this whole 403 analysis is done, and most of the cases that you find talk about a multiplicity of photos, I understand what your position is, that even these two shouldn't have been shown. But
right. I mean, usually the cases surface when the defense counsel comes in at trial. They're objecting to try to say, you don't need to show the dead body. You don't need to show the scene. Well, I mean, that argument is a losing cause. Here, these photos are on a different level altogether. And they're enough to incite the jury to come out with death. That's assuming that the unadjudicated murders itself should have been allowed. And our position is, notwithstanding any of the constitutional arguments or statutory prohibitive arguments that we have in the brief, we're contending that it should be reversed because there's an undue undue passion and prejudice. And the statute allows this court to grant relief based on that on 18 U.S.C. 3595C2.
But I go back again to my original question, because the aggravating factor at issue is his future danger to others and his pattern of violence. And, of course, the court excluded all but two of the photographs. And how else could the government have offered a demonstration, let us say, of the depravity of the crime?
By the testimony describing it, and I think that's enough. Do you need to see the results of how a dead body looks like after it's burnt without the talking about that it's enough?
Well, see, the problem is, of course, for you, that most of the circuits have said yes. The Supreme Court hasn't spoken, perhaps, but when you look at, you know, the appellate decisions that are out there, your road is tough here, isn't it?
Well, first of all, those other prior, there's only, obviously, there aren't as many people on death row in the federal system as there are in the state, and there's only a smattering of cases. And if you look at the cases that there are, this, unless something has popped out recently, this is the only case where an unadjudicated murder has been submitted. All the unadjudicated crimes itself have not been as severe. And there's, we proffer the argument here to this court that there's a spillover effect. And the spillover effect is, based on this particular record, is that he wouldn't have been found guilty of this in Atlanta. Of this crime. The spillover effect is the jury evaluated whether he did this particular crime after finding him guilty of the two murders in Indiana. Therefore, presupposing that he's capable of doing that. And I think a fair analysis in evaluating whether there's undue passion and prejudice in the omission of this evidence, could they have been convinced of this crime without him being convicted of the underlying murders?
Now, I want to go into a little different area on the unadjudicated murder, because you argued that the court erred in refusing to allow residual doubt arguments or instructions as to the unadjudicated murder, not the offense of conviction, but the residual doubt instruction that was tendered to the court related only to the offense of conviction. So was this argument even raised to the district court?
Well, it was raised because they wanted to argue it, not so much even the instruction. I think the fallback argument that has been preserved by the defense counsel was that they should have at least been allowed to make the argument of residual doubt as to the Lanner crime itself.
But how can you have a residual doubt instruction as to a matter that is determined for the first time at sentencing? It seems to me that residual doubt arguments relate to doubts that remain after a guilt determination, not to those harbored before it's made. So how does that have relevance to a guilt determination that is made initially at the sentencing phase?
I mean, obviously you pointed out a problem about it, but that also highlights why you should probably not have unadjudicated claims in the nature of what we have before the court. The evidence against him was rather sketchy, and I'll go through that in a minute. And so with counsel, putting aside, they raised two, I believe in the record, two prongs. They've argued that he should have been entitled to argue residual doubt by instruction, but they did raise a throwback argument that they should at least able to argue residual doubt as to the Atlanta issue, which was raised for the first time. That's what opens up the Pandora's box by allowing these unadjudicated claims, particularly a claim of this sensitive nature. You can weigh all sorts of judicial economy. Well, he committed this armed robbery or he committed another burglary. But what we have here is an offense that is just as equal to the crime that he was convicted of, or worse. And I think that opens up serious questions under the statute, which has really not hardly been interpreted, is what does it mean, what type of review this court has under 18 U.S.C. 3595C2, passion and prejudice. And I think it's a fair argument to say when the standard is the government has to show that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that the unadjudicated claim here clearly prejudiced him. One, he didn't have a profile of this type of murder prior to his conviction. What was his record before this is that he was convicted of some marijuana offenses, some receiving stolen property. And the evidence indicates that there's a dying declaration of another individual saying somebody else did the crime.
Mr. Freeman, did you identify with particularity anywhere, which I might have missed, the residual doubt arguments that you were prevented from making? Well, not you, but...
I believe whatever's there is in the record, and I think we put them in the abstract. You know, we can. There's not a lot on it. I mean, it was put in there at the last minute, and there are sections in the record in the closing argument where counsel's attempting to make the residual doubt argument, and the attorney for the government objected, and the court said you're not having any form of residual doubt.
The residual doubt issue has been put to rest by the Supreme Court's recent decision in Oregon versus Guzik, isn't it?
That's not alive
in the case anymore.
I don't think so. I think what the wording of the opinion is it's a very narrow issue, is whether you could present in a traditional death penalty case in the state court where somebody says, I didn't do it, and then they want to present new residual evidence to argue residual doubt. And here, this is totally different because we're dealing with an unadjudicated claim in a federal system. So you've got a totally different type of problem. And one, they didn't reach the question whether you could argue residual doubt arguing the same evidence. I mean, and I think the opinion, I mean, there was a couple of dissents by the Supreme Court saying, no, you can't do it at all. But the majority of the court said, we're going to leave that question open. And that's why we've raised it here is on direct appeal.
I know you have other issues you want to go on to.
No, I'm willing to answer. It's more important that I answer the questions. As to go through quickly the facts indicate that this case is inappropriate for the unadjudicated murder to have gotten in. The testimony is questionable. The people that were testified about circumstantial evidence. They were not demeaning their lifestyle, but they were all using cocaine crack before the incident. It's a high crime area. The only evidence that was connected to him was him. They were seeing him, whether he was close by. The people that did indicate that he had a prior confrontation with Wanda McNeil, that person happened to be Will Johnson, who Wanda identified as the one who was involved with the setting her on fire. And also, as to the unadjudicated claim, it's interesting that the state itself, the state of Georgia, the body that's supposed to adjudicate that claim, didn't do so. And it's not just, it was not only was it nolly pros because witnesses didn't show up, they never went back to the grand jury.
Why should that matter if the jury in this case adjudicated the conduct beyond a reasonable doubt with the applicable presumption of innocence and all of the other procedural protections that a defendant in an ordinary guilt proceeding would be entitled to?
When you use an unadjudicated claim in a sentencing phase, they're not getting all the unusual protections. They're getting the presumption that he's on a spillover effect, that he's likely to have committed this murder. And I'm saying to truly evaluate this claim independently, if it was in Georgia, they would have not heard the Indiana robbery. One, because it didn't occur. But let's assuming arguendo that the Indiana murder had occurred. They wouldn't have heard it in the guilt phase. They would have heard the burning case, they would have heard it straight up without any other factors, and that's the danger of the spillover effect in this particular case.
How is it any different from adjudicating unadjudicated other acts evidence in an ordinary guilt phase?
But there's some other acts cases at least meet the standard of 404B, for example, a federal statute, a plan, you know, plan, motive, opportunity. There's no connection. This evidence would have not met that type of standard, nor did the government make that argument. They made it under future dangerousness. And that's what the difference is. This would not have met Rule 8 of the Federal Civil Criminal Procedure. It would have not met 404B standards, and that's the particular problem, at least what I'm submitting to the court, is why it shouldn't be submitted. I would also just quickly indicate that we also submit there should be no dispute that admission of this type of evidence caused prejudice. It was a pivotal point of the government's case. They mentioned it throughout the closing arguments. And, you know, with the standard, ultimately, that the government has to prove that the error was beyond, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, you couldn't make it with such evidence. One final point about the prejudice of this type of evidence. I think when you look at the questionnaires that the jury's filled out in the case, it's not even clear whether they even found this by unanimous. They said they did, and they filled out the verdict form saying, yes, we find, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. But if you look at the special interrogatories that were submitted about mitigation, two of the juries found that he didn't have a significant prior history. Well, I mean, you mean I'm certainly willing to concede that if you're convicted of a murder of this nature in Atlanta, that he would have a significant prior history, but two filled out that he didn't, and that would be a basis for mitigation. So I either the jury was confused, and there's an indication that they weren't found unanimously, and that shows, along with the other mitigating factors in this case, that if you take out the Atlanta off the scale, the Atlanta homicide off the scale, the other mitigating factors, I submit that you can't show beyond a reasonable doubt that those numbers would have been more elevated, and you can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that they would not have, that they would have automatically given the death penalty. The final issue that I want to just mention briefly is the Batson claim.
Then let me start you out with a question.
Sure.
Isn't there a qualitative difference between the DNA remarks by RJ, or rather RG, and those by MS and BK, in that RG repeatedly raised the issue on his own in the questionnaire and at least implied that a conviction could not be trusted absent DNA evidence? What remarks by MS would you say were of that intensity?
The intensity of MS, and if I can just refer back to my notes just quickly, because it would be probably the most critical, was MS said on her questionnaire number 35. She said her question statement, I understand that there are times when people are wrongly found guilty and due to this misinformation from the police and attorneys. And she also mentioned the situation with George Ryan commuting everybody on death row in Illinois, along with the lack of questioning in comparisons to the questionings that GR had to go through. I think that would be the factor there.
Is it GR or RG?
It's GR.
Sorry.
I mean, I think at one point the judge referred to him, his first name is James, but it's really not. It's Robert, and that's where there's some confusion.
Now, how are the remarks by BK relevant, given that they didn't generally relate to the DNA issue at all and spoke of a lower burden of proof than reasonable doubt?
But I think that she didn't understand the terms she was using, and I think BK is a stronger indication of the problem here than even MS, because she was on On the questionnaire BK, she said, I believe the death penalty is a necessary punishment, but with the rising number of recent reversals, the evidence must be very compelling to sentence someone to death. And
but neither of them indicated that the DNA evidence had caused them to reconsider their positions on the death penalty, you know.
But neither did RG ultimately. Ultimately, when he was asked the question straight up, if you were involved, I mean, he was posed, GR was put straight up, was posed the questions, if you were involved in a death penalty case and heard no evidence about DNA, would that change the way you would look at the evidence in the case? And he says, no. And if would you
after quite a bit of going back and forth, and of course we have the added issue of RG's relative that he had believed for many, many years had been wrongly convicted. And he spent, you know, I mean, I realized that later he found out that the relative was guilty, but he spent many years believing that the justice system had been unfair to this relative.
But I mean, that was as a child. As an adult, he said he could decide the case fairly. I think, it, particularly here, if you find that the I submit the stronger part of the case is that there's no difference in the DNA remarks ultimately made by BK with GR. And if you believe that's pretextual, then the subjective reasoning must also fall. And that's the particular problem here. And I think when you match them up in this racially sensitive case, I mean, I want to say, I mean, there's no question that we can see that this is not Miller-El. This is not Miller-El. There's no indication that the U.S. attorneys are racist. They're just, I submit they're smart and well-trained and skillful lawyers trying to get a tactical advantage, believing that in a death penalty case of this nature, that you want to limit the number of blacks. They're smart enough to know you can't eliminate all the blacks. That would be a red flag, and that would be inappropriate. They were just trying to take an unfair tactical advantage. And that violates Batson. I just want to say, I mean, in after Miller-El, and one quote, I think they do match up, and there's one quote from Miller-El, I think, that's important to us, and Justice Souter said, a per se rule, the defendant can't win a Batson claim unless there is an exact identical white juror would lead the Batson that would leave Batson inoperable. Penalty jurors would not be a productive set of cookie cutter rules. They don't have to be perfect, and I think they're close. And that's at 125 Supreme Court Reporter 2329. They don't have to be absolutely perfect, and I think we meet the case here. And also, alternatively, we submit that the district court did not go through the three prongs. He stopped and said the state met their, they came with a neutral reason but didn't go through the weighing process. With that, I will sit down unless there's any more questions of the court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Friedman. Good morning, Mr. Bella.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is an appeal from a conviction and sentence for committing a bank robbery resulting in the death of two victims. On August 27 of 2002, Odell Corley entered a small bank branch in Pines, Indiana, firing his gun as soon as he entered. He shot security guard Keith Hill two times, paralyzing him for life. He fired shots toward a louvered door while going toward the teller counter, hitting a male bank teller, Chandler Simpson, in the head, causing injuries which eventually killed him. He leaped onto a counter, shot a female bank teller, Kay Peckett, as she cowered, hunched over, trying to seek shelter on the other side of the teller counter, killing her. Corley raises an array of issues on appeal. In oral argument, he dwelled upon the unadjudicated crimes evidence and on the Batson challenge. And so I will turn, first of all, to the unadjudicated crimes evidence.
And can you talk about the 404B analysis, which, of course, is a protection when someone is on trial originally for the offense? And aren't there some concerns raised here by the possibility that the jury had just found him guilty, and wouldn't they be more inclined to find him responsible for the unconvicted heinous murder than to just use it to determine his sentence?
The 404B analysis is applies to a different sort of situation, because the government didn't proffer this evidence in the case in chief. It was part of the sentencing phase,
right,
to prove future dangerousness. As to the spillover effect, we consistently rely upon jurors to follow the instructions of the court, to sort out the evidence, and to evaluate different charges independently. There are jurors will hear multiple counts of an indictment, and they're presumed to follow the instructions and be able to sort out that evidence.
Well, have any courts that introduced where the evidence introduced of the uncharged conduct has a court allowed evidence of unconvicted murders or unconvicted conduct that could be seen as more heinous than the charged conduct?
Well, Your Honor, the short answer to that is the cases cited are not cases where the uncharged conduct was murdered. On the other hand, the courts have repeatedly held that uncharged, unadjudicated conduct is admissible in the penalty phase of death penalty cases.
But see, we've got this murder, which is distinguishable from the cases, and then wouldn't you agree that this burning was more heinous even? It's hard to, you know, sort of weigh, of course, all these were, it's horrible what happened to the victims in the bank robbery. But looking at this burning, and then particularly when these photos are introduced, you know, this is more heinous than the charged conduct.
Well, I would say that either we're going to have a rule that unadjudicated conduct is admissible in the penalty phase of death penalty trials, or we're not. And if it's admissible, then I don't think it makes much sense to say that it's admissible if it's not really bad conduct. But if it's really bad conduct, you can't admit it.
Were the photographs that were admitted by the district court representative of the 15 photographs that the government sought to introduce? In other words, what I'm looking for here is, were they either more graphic or less graphic than the ones that were rejected?
My impression is that they were no more graphic and perhaps less graphic than the ones rejected. I didn't try the case, but the court sorted through the photographs, had concerns over how much of the body was revealed, more modesty concerns, I think, with regard to some of the other photographs. The photographs, I think there's a couple reasons why the photographs are relevant. One is the cruelty with which the defendant committed that crime is an indicator of the defendant's character, and that character was squarely before the jury in the sentencing phase of this case. Another is that the photographs tend to humanize the victim of the crime. This isn't just some nameless or some person that the jury hasn't seen before, Wanda McNeil, a.k.a. Wonder Woman. This is a real human being. And so photographs, I think, are commonly introduced in crimes of violence and homicide cases to show that this is a real victim who is alive, and also to display the injuries that the victim suffered. I would suggest to the court that these photos, there aren't a lot of crimes of violence of this sort that come through the federal system. Usually it's the subject matter of state criminal offenses. And so we don't see a lot of pictures in the federal system. And I don't want to minimize the photographs that were introduced, or certainly not the injuries, but in comparison to the kinds of things that we see in state court in crimes of violence, these photographs were not particularly gruesome compared to other kinds of crimes. And I don't want to sound insensitive when I say that, but there are certainly more horrific photographs that are introduced commonly in state court.
There was extensive descriptions, though, of the extent of the burning, that right in the testimony.
Yes. Yes, there was. And I go back to the fact that if you can describe the injuries, certainly you could have photographs of them. And I go back to what I just said, that the photographs convey to the jury this is a real person. It humanizes the victim, and it also conveys to the jury the cruelty of which the defendant committed that offense, which, again, I stress, was squarely in front of the jury, because the purpose of the sentencing phase in the death penalty case is for the jury to determine the defendant's character. And that character is relevant to future dangerousness. And the depravity or cruelty with which the defendant commits criminal conduct is part of what the jury is to consider in the sentencing phase of these sorts of cases. The courts of the Supreme Court in Williams versus New York, and the courts in the government cited courts in the 10th Circuit, 4th Circuit, 8th, 5th, 9th, and 11th Circuits, all of which have held that unadjudicated crimes evidence is admissible in the death penalty, in the penalty phase of death penalty cases. The Death Penalty Act itself, you have to look at, in looking at the Death Penalty Act, the overall scheme of the act is to admit evidence. There is a particular provision of the act, which the defendant has cited on appeal, regarding potentially prejudicial evidence, which is more restrictive than the federal rules of evidence. But the act as a whole is intended to admit evidence. The Fell case cited by the defendant said, and I quote, "More evidence, not less, should be admitted on the presence or absence of aggravating and mitigating factors." The Gregg case, a Supreme Court case cited by the government, quote, "So long as the evidence introduced at the pre-sentence hearing, at sentencing hearing, do not prejudice the defendant, it is preferable not to impose restrictions. We think it is desirable for the jury to have as much information before it as possible when it makes the sentencing decision." And the Lee case, quote, "The Federal Death Penalty Act erects very low barriers to the admission of evidence at capital sentencing hearings. Parties may present evidence as to any matter relevant to sentence." And the act itself has the catch-all provision. In 18 U.S.C. 3593C, the act says that at the sentencing hearing, information may be presented as to any matter relevant to sentence. And in 18 U.S.C. 3592C, it likewise states the jury, quote, "may consider whether any other aggravating factor," unquote, "supports a death sentence."
Now, in that Eighth Circuit Lee case, when the court did allow that evidence in, the court said the acts were not substantially different in kind or degree than those brought out by the government during its case in chief. Are the past bad acts required to be of a similar kind and degree?
No court has said that, Your Honor. All these courts have allowed unadjudicated crimes evidence, and none have imposed those sorts of restrictions. And I would indicate that the government's burden at the sentencing hearing is to show that the defendant's character and the way he committed his engaged in his criminal conduct is so severe as to justify imposition of the ultimate penalty. And so the kind of evidence that you're going to see at those hearings is going to be some pretty severe evidence, and that's what we had in the Atlanta homicide. There is a tension, I think, in the Death Penalty Act, and the Beckford Court noted it. In the act encourages the admission of as much evidence as possible before the jury so that they could fully evaluate the defendant's character. And yet there's a concern because the death penalty is qualitatively different than other kinds of penalties. and there's a concern that the jury only consider reliable evidence. And
well,
so,
and the court here did hold a reliability hearing.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And the court in Beckford, it balanced those two competing but important concerns by saying that what we will do to assure the reliability of evidence and yet allow the jury to hear all relevant evidence to the defendant's character is to hold such a hearing. And the court here did the same thing. In fact, this court, I think, adopted a very conservative approach. The court in Beckford said that what it would require is that the government present the evidence to the court and the defendant regarding the unadjudicated conduct. It didn't say how it would be presented. Presumably, reports and proffers would suffice, but in some manner, it would present, the government would present the evidence, allowing the court to evaluate it. Here, the court went a step further. This court held a full hearing with the witnesses subject to cross-examination by the defendant. The witnesses testified in person before the court, subject to cross-examination. And following that hearing, this court made a threshold determination, not just that the evidence was reliable, but in the court's eyes, the evidence was sufficient to prove the Atlanta homicide beyond a reasonable doubt. This court took a very conservative approach, and I think this court acted appropriately in erecting these barriers to the Atlanta evidence coming in to assure that the evidence was reliable before this jury heard the evidence. I'm not sure what the defendant would ask the courts to do when to avoid the notion of the spillover effect. Would the defendant ask the court to have a trial before the jury to determine guilt of the bank robbery, then adjourn that and have an entirely different jury determine the Atlanta evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, and then come back to the jury that determined the bank robbery and present that evidence to that jury? At some point, one jury is going to hear both about the robbery and about the Atlanta evidence. At some point, one jury has to hear both of them in order to make that determination as to the proper penalty to impose upon the defendant. In this case, the jury heard the robbery evidence in determining guilt, and then it heard the Atlanta evidence. What purpose would it serve if we were to, say, adjourn this proceeding and have another jury hear the Atlanta evidence to determine it beyond a reasonable doubt? One purpose, I suppose, would be that there would be a conviction now of the Atlanta homicide, but the cases don't require that. The cases I cited from all these different circuits indicate that unadjudicated evidence is admissible in the penalty of phase of capital cases. So that's not required. Another concern that would be served by that procedure, that cumbersome procedure, would be to assure the reliability of the Atlanta evidence. But that concern was satisfied in this case by the trial court in engaging in the procedure it did by holding the full hearing with witnesses subject to cross-examination and satisfying itself that the Atlanta evidence was reliable and sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the Atlanta crime. And so that purpose was served here.
Yeah, because your point is, even if it was a not guilty, let's assume there was a separate jury that made the determination, that could still be introduced. That's your point to the jury that's doing the sentencing. In other words, if it was a guilty, you would have a conviction that you would go to the death jury, quote, on. But if it was a not guilty, the prosecutor could still introduce it.
Well,
in the sentencing phase, is that your position?
No. My point is that I'm asking what the defendant would suggest that we do to avoid the spillover effect.
Right.
And this cumbersome procedure of sitting another jury is the only thing I can think of that would satisfy that. But the cases don't require that, and the concerns that the defendant has that the evidence be reliable before a jury hears it, those concerns are satisfied by what the court did here.
So I guess I'm asking then, if there were a separate jury and there was a not guilty verdict, obviously that would inure to the benefit of the defendant. And let's assume there was a not guilty verdict. And in with the could that murder then be utilized in the sentencing phase? Death penalty case.
I can't imagine that a prosecutor would seek to do that.
Right.
I can't imagine that they would. And there was never a determination on the merits in Atlanta.
Right.
There was the detective didn't show up to a couple of preliminary hearings, and that was the case was just dropped. So that has nothing to do. That has no bearing on this case. There was never a determination on the merits.
Well, a not guilty verdict doesn't preclude admission of that conduct as other acts evidence in a standard criminal trial. So why would it be precluded in this context?
I'm not suggesting it would legally be precluded. I'm just suggesting that as a practical matter, the prosecutor probably would not seek to rely on that in a capital case. So I guess I'm just looking at the practical aspect of that. Looking at the Atlanta evidence, the defendant tends to discount the Atlanta evidence in his argument. However, if you look at that evidence, you can see why the district court found the evidence to be sufficient to establish the Atlanta homicide beyond a reasonable doubt. There was a dispute between Corley and Wanda McNeil and McNeil's brother the night before the homicide. The next day, Corley was at Will Johnson's house asking for Wanda McNeil. He said she had set him up to be robbed. An hour later, Corley was back at the Johnson house, and he had a fight with Wanda McNeil on the porch, and Johnson told him to leave. So Corley clearly had a motive and was seeking to inflict harm on Wanda McNeil. Later that day, there was a fire at Wanda McNeil's brother's house. Immediately after, Corley was at Will Johnson's house again. Arthur Smith, who was at the house, was leaving the house to go across the street, and Corley asked Smith, "Where's Wanda?" And Arthur Smith said, "She's on the porch." Jackie Cunningham and Wanda McNeil were asleep on the porch, and Jackie Cunningham wakes up on the porch to see Wanda McNeil in flames, and he sees somebody descending a step at the end of the yard to the street. Arthur Smith, who had just gone across the street for a minute, and now is returning across the street to the Johnson house, is coming back across the street, and he sees the fire, and he sees Corley running from the house. The implication is that the person that Jackie Cunningham saw descending the step to the street when he woke up to see the flames, and the person that Arthur Smith saw, that is Corley, running from the house when he saw the flames, that those are one and the same person. There's a gas can in Corley's vehicle. The gas can is from his place of employment. It's recognized by a coworker. The water bottle found on the lawn of the Johnson house is a water bottle matching one that Corley wears around his neck at work, and it smelled of gasoline. Again, a coworker identified the water bottle with a lanyard as the same kind of water bottle that Corley wears at work. Corley was with a coworker after the fire, staying at their house, and he wakes up in the middle of the night with a nightmare, saying she's on fire. Corley is in the vehicle with a coworker, headed toward a job out of town, and he says, "Well, if I killed her, I had a reason." And the coworker was sufficiently upset at Corley's demeanor when Corley said that, the coworker refused to ride further. He called a supervisor at work, and the supervisor said, if you leave that van, you're fired. And yet the coworker felt strongly enough about what Corley said and the way he said it that he left the van and he was fired. He lost his job. And then there's Corley's logbook, where he writes of burned bodies found in the corners of porches. This whole sequence of events shows the dispute between Corley and McNeil, shows Corley was looking for McNeil because he thought she'd set him up somehow. It shows two witnesses present when the fire occurred, seeing Corley leaving the Johnson property at the time of the fire, the gas can in Corley's truck, the water bottle with the lanyard that Corley wears around his neck at work. I would suggest that the evidence is compelling on the Atlanta homicide, and defense indicated that this would not result in a conviction in Atlanta, and I would beg to disagree with that. Had this case been tried in Atlanta, this evidence was sufficient to convict Corley of that homicide. And this is the evidence that the district court found compelling enough to assure that it was sufficient to convict Corley of the Atlanta homicide beyond a reasonable doubt and reliable enough to present to the jury in the penalty phase of this case. Turning now to the Batson issue.
Was there anything in GR's responses to questioning during voir dire that would have caused the prosecutor to believe that he would be reluctant to convict absent DNA evidence?
During voir dire, RG gave the appropriate answers when asked if he could judge the evidence. However, he also expressed lingering concerns both over DNA evidence and over his relative who had been convicted of robbery. He indicated that he would feel much more comfortable with DNA evidence if that were introduced. Also, I would indicate to the court that the government is not bound by a juror's responses during voir dire. In fact, there's even more reason to be concerned when responses during voir dire contradict a juror's responses on the questionnaire. And RG's responses on the questionnaire were clearly qualitatively different than those of BK or MS. MS didn't even mention DNA evidence. BK mentioned it almost in passing when responding to the question about publicity. He said she'd heard about the recent reversals in Illinois of death penalty cases due to DNA evidence, whereas RG dwelled repeatedly on DNA evidence. He used to have debates with his friend where he defended the death penalty. Following the advent of DNA evidence, he had to change his mind, eat crow, if you will, because he had to back off on his previous position with his friend regarding the death penalty. And then he goes on to say now he wonders how many people were wrongfully put to death on death row due to the lack of DNA evidence. That goes far beyond what BK said in her questionnaire. And as I said, MS didn't even mention DNA evidence in her questionnaire. This was a bank robbery death penalty case. And in addition to the DNA issue, RG also had a close relative, someone he looked up to, who had been convicted of robbery when he was young, and he didn't feel good about it. He felt that person had been pulled from him. And this is a bank robbery death penalty case. I would suggest that no prosecutor would feel comfortable with having a juror who had concerns both about people perhaps wrongfully being put to death because of the lack of DNA evidence, and also have concerns over a close relative who had been convicted of robbery. And here there was going to be no DNA evidence in this trial. Everybody knew it, the prosecution, the defense, the court. And any prosecutor who has a prospective juror who has both those concerns in a death penalty bank robbery case would not in his right mind retain a juror such as RG, I would suggest to the court. Not where this is the same offense of which his relative had been convicted, not where there's not going to be any DNA evidence in this case, where RG is wondering how many people were wrongfully put to death because of that. And that has nothing to do with race. But with those kinds of responses, it's clear that the government had ample reason to strike RG on non-racial grounds. And the court, I would suggest, the court also went to the third stage. The court heard the Batson challenge by Corley. The court heard the government's response, as I've just indicated. And then the court made a specific finding that the government's response was unrelated. It was a race-neutral response, and also that the government was clearly upset, clearly agitated or concerned about RG's responses regarding DNA evidence and regarding his relative's robbery conviction. And the government had the government strike was based upon race-neutral grounds. And the court specifically made those findings when the Batson challenge was made at the trial court level. With regard to the residual doubt instruction, the court in Oregon versus Guzik, it did decide a narrow question of whether new evidence could be introduced to make the issue of residual doubt before the jury. But the court also made the point that where evidence is allowed during sentencing phases of trials regarding the circumstances of the underlying crime, the evidence showed how the crime was committed, not whether the defendant committed the crime. And in this case, the defendant's defense in the case in chief wasn't that the crime was committed in some different fashion. His defense was alibi, that is, that he did not commit the crime at all. That is the presentation of residual doubt argument is inconsistent with the theory of defense. The defense was that the defendant was not there at all and did not commit the crime. And I'd suggest that the court's comments in Oregon versus Guzik indicate that the Supreme Court would not allow a residual doubt instruction, certainly not in these sorts of circumstances.
Well, but it leaves open the question as to whether a defendant has a right to introduce residual doubt evidence at sentencing. Just that you can't introduce new alibi evidence that's inconsistent with the conviction that was available at the time of the original trial.
Well, I think that the court's comments in Oregon versus Guzik would indicate that it would not allow this residual doubt instruction. I also point out that this residual doubt instruction, the way it's written, is directed toward the substantive offense. It's not directed toward the Atlanta homicide.
Pretty aware of.
The defense has not argued on appeal, or not argued here in oral argument, anything with regard to the allegations of prosecutorial misconduct. Touching on those briefly, I would indicate that the cross-examination concerning the news reports was adequately dealt with by the court. Cross-examination regarding finances was appropriate, given the comments that the defendant made during his testimony. And the comment during the closing argument was an invited response by the defense, and that none of those things affected the jury's verdict here. The jury's verdict here was based not on the photographs and not on those comments by the prosecution. The jury's verdict here was based upon the strength of the evidence, both as to the bank robbery and as to the Atlanta crimes. And it was based upon the cruelty with which the defendant committed both the bank robbery and the Atlanta homicide. The defendant, having leaped over the counter, leaving a palm print on the counter, and shot a cowering teller on the other side of the counter, that has more to do with the jury's verdict here than the things that the defense complains about on appeal. And the defendant's actions in Atlanta and the manner in which he committed the Atlanta homicide against Wanda McNeil, that has more to do with the jury's verdict than the things that the defense argues on appeal, I would suggest to the court. And this conviction and the sentence should be affirmed.
Mr. Bella, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Friedman, you have 7 minutes.
Just briefly, I mean, I submit that the death penalty statute, which really has hardly been interpreted, the 18 section 395 C2 provides the safety valve for defendants here, and this unadjudicated murder should not have been submitted. I submit that based on the record, there's a reason why the prosecutions in Atlanta, the prosecutors in Atlanta did not proceed with this case after the preliminary hearing was over. They would have a difficult time getting a conviction. And they used, in this case, it was used was bootstrapped by the underlying murders. We're not saying here that there should be two separate trials. We're saying it shouldn't be admitted at all. Generally, unadjudicated claims, and you can see this in a pattern of the cases in the federal system, but of course, in the bulk of the death penalties in the state cases, they're usually types of crimes that the state doesn't want to bother to prosecute. They're usually, or they meet the 404B standard, pattern in practice. They don't usually come in with a homicide of this nature and not have it adjudicated unless there's a reason. And the review of these facts in this case indicate that this is highly prejudicial to allow such a fact like that after another individual, the victim himself, herself, said somebody else did the crime. I mean, the evidence is circumstantial. It's based on they're talking about a common water bottle that somebody else could have bought in any other store. They're talking about individuals placing it at the scene, but their testimony is highly suspect and inconsistent in the record. And so this is a rather unique case, and actually almost the case of first impression before this court, because there's so few adjudicated claims of this particular nature. I think the better argument, I believe it is preserved, obviously you're going to have an opportunity to take a close look at the record, is that they should have been allowed a residual doubt argument as to the Atlanta. It sort of tied the defense counsel behind their back. This is the first time they get to put it on, and that's another problem about adjudicated claims of this type of nature. They usually are more minor crimes, or usually meet the pattern of 404B. And so we urge this court to take a close look at, there's very little legislative history, I believe there is none, we would have cited it, as to that actual statute that says the appellate court on direct appeal can use and find that there's passion and prejudice in the evidence submitted. If this court has any questions, we would stand on our brief on the remaining claims.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for such a well-argued appeal. And the case will be taken under advisement, and the court will stand down until heaven only knows when. All right. Thank you.